This is Local Motion, KVNF's weekly public affairs show. I'm your host this week, Brody Wilson. This week on Local Motion, we're covering two topics. First, we'll visit the West Slope Water Summit that occurred last week down in Montrose. And in the second half, we'll head up to Gunnison, where KVNF's Laura Palmisano brings us an interview with Susan Wyman, a regenerative farmer working to train the next diverse generation of farmers. That's all this week on Local Motion. We hope you'll stick around. If you're not able to stick around for the next half an hour, you can listen to the full episode at your convenience by looking for Local Motion under the News tab at kvnf.org. We'll start down in Montrose at the West Slope Water Summit. The West Slope Water Summit drew a full house last week in Montrose. Ranchers, ditch company leaders, engineers, city and county officials, and residents who simply wanted to understand what's happening to the river that shapes every part of life here on the Western Slope. Montrose City Manager Bill Bell said he came to listen.
And I'm here to learn about the future of water and why it's such an important thing, not only for the ag producers in our area, but also for the city of Montrose and our city residents.
Montrose County Commissioner Sue Hansen helped start the event 7 years ago. She's term limited, and next year's event will be her last.
The Water Summit started 7 years ago out of a community suggestion to, you know, we need to know more about water. We need to learn what the problems are with subdivisions. We need to learn what the problem and challenges are for our water users. So in response to that, we decided to put this together. So it's been fun.
But this year's summit felt a little different, mainly because the situation with the Colorado River is getting more dire each year. The day began with a stark hydrology update from the Colorado River District's Raquel Flinker. She gave an overview of just how dry last winter was, but also how hot the spring was, and how that led to Lake Powell inflows that landed well below half of the early season's forecast. The primary point of Raquel's talk was that it's getting much more difficult with today's climate to forecast what she calls snow to flow, a correlation that used to be reliable, but these days less so.
And so this puzzle is really hard, and it's changing because temperatures are going up, less precipitation is falling as snow. And because of that, snow is becoming less of a predictor of river flows.
The Colorado River District is funded by property taxes from 15 Western Slope counties. The River District's general manager, Andy Mueller, is a regular presenter at the West Slope Water Summit, and he usually gives an update on Colorado River policy and politics. As he spoke this year, it became clear that he was speaking with a different tone than he had in recent years. His presentation was one of the bluntest assessments of the Colorado River negotiations that the summit has ever heard, and it was especially pointed toward Arizona water negotiators, who he called unhinged. 2 days before the summit, on November 11th, representatives from the upper and lower basin states had let a federal deadline from the Department of the Interior come and go without reaching a compromise. Throughout his talk, Andy Mueller made his case for why Western Slope communities should not face additional water cuts. After the conference, I asked him to summarize his position.
You know, over 100 years ago, we agreed to an apportionment of the Colorado River to allow all communities within the river basin to thrive. And what we have is a basic building block of a community, which is water. We apportioned it between the states in order to do that. We're not trying to take Arizona's water to build our communities. We're just using the water that was apportioned to us over 100 years ago. What they are trying to do at this point in the game is take the water that our communities depend upon. And the answer is no, you can't have it. The law says no, we're not going to dry up and blow away just because you want to grow in a way that is unsustainable. Build the Taiwan semiconductor plant should never have been built in Arizona. It should have been built in Alabama or Ohio and put people to work there.
In his talk, Andy referred to an op-ed that Tom Buchowski, the lead negotiator for the state of Arizona, had published in the Denver Post. The letter was also co-signed by all of the Arizona state legislators.
Well, back in September, literally the day before a critical meeting of the seven states, Tom Buchowski, the lead negotiator for the state of Arizona, got an op-ed piece in the Denver Post. And I've got a quote in here that says, hey, you know, we have to engage in mandatory reductions, right? That's what he's saying. But what I didn't put up here, because it was so inflammatory, is his rhetoric in there that, in my mind, shows the guy was completely unhinged in early September. He said that Arizona shall not perish from the face of this earth, right? That's how he's feeling. He's feeling like, holy crap, this could happen. That's what I read in there. Well, and I started thinking about it. Why would the lead negotiator for the state of Arizona feel like they were in threat of perishing? And why would he be blaming us for that? Well, does anybody remember what the name of their biggest city is? And I would also point out the fastest growing city in North America, right? Phoenix. Because why is it called Phoenix? Because it rose from the ashes of a civilization that died because it didn't have enough water. Great place to have the fastest growing city in North America, right? During the millennial drought that we've never seen before. I would maybe feel like we were going to perish from the face of the earth too if I lived there. So I guess he's not as unhinged as I thought.
The core of the current conflict is that the Upper Basin, including Colorado, argues it already lives within the actual flows of the river and its compact obligations, especially in dry years. The Lower Basin states, especially Arizona, are fighting to protect as much of their historic use as they can, even as Lakes Powell and Meade have dropped sharply. They point to the reductions they've already agreed to and argue that the Upper Basin should commit to its own share of structured cuts. Under prior appropriation, the water law in Colorado, junior water users here get cut off when stream and river flows are insufficient. Families, farms, and ranches go without water. That's our system. It's painful for those junior users, but it works. Those who put the water to use first get their fair share first, and junior users get what remains above that. But in the Lower Basin, especially Arizona, cities and farms have grown through the last 25 years of drought by leaning on big reservoir releases and widespread groundwater pumping, tools that don't exist here at the same scale or under the same rules.
This is what we do to adjust to hydrology. We do it every dry year. And in fact, somewhere in our state, we're doing it every year because of the drought. It moves around and hits different places. So it's really important to understand living within the hydrology. What happened in Arizona during the same period of time, right? Well, and by the way, over the last, if you look at the last 25 years, we have in the Upper Basin, the total four states, not had about 1.3 million acre feet a year of water because of drought. That we, normal full production, we would have needed an additional 1.3 million acre feet of water a year. We didn't have it because we didn't build massive reservoirs above us. We weren't able to do that because the water comes from here and you don't have that volume to store. Down in the Lower Basin, at the turn of the millennium, those two reservoirs, 50 million acre feet, were full or almost full. And so what happened over the last 25 years during drought? Did Arizona crank its water use down? Not at all. In fact, Arizona knew from the 1968 law that I'm talking about how they operate the reservoirs and coordinated, that same act authorized the building of the Central Arizona Project. That act, that's the pumping system and canal that runs over 300 miles to Phoenix out of the Colorado River and provides Colorado River water to Phoenix and Tucson. They built that because 1968 Act said they could do that and gave them $480 million in 1968 to do that from the federal government. In exchange for that, they agreed to have the junior right on the Colorado River, meaning that in times of drought, they were supposed to cut it off, right? So the last 25 years, did they cut it off? No. What they did is they upped their diversions by 300 to 500,000 acre feet a year, and they brought that through the Central Arizona Project and put it into something called groundwater infiltration basins, which are in the middle of the desert in the hot 100 plus degree weather, and thought some of that water would percolate down into the groundwater and they'd be able to store it there and pump it up someday when they finally got cut off. So they accelerated the demise of the reservoirs by pumping an additional almost 10 million acre feet of water into the desert and down into the ground. By the way, they're still trying to figure out if they can get any of that back out. Okay? And once they did all that, and in 2022, for the first time ever, remember, we've experienced these cuts every year because that's how prior appropriation works. 2022, they were finally told by the federal government, you know what, there's a shortage. You need to stop your pumping here. You need to reduce your canal. And they screamed and they hollered and they looked upstream and they said, hey, it's Colorado's fault. It's Utah's fault. It's Wyoming's fault. It's New Mexico's fault. So that's their self-righteous platform that they're sitting on, saying we need to settle and we need to enact mandatory water cuts in our state because of what they deem to be important, which is their growth.
Not surprisingly, that messaging landed very well with the agricultural producers and water officials from the Western Slope that were in the room.
In case you haven't noticed, I've taken the gloves off in this public dispute with Arizona. I'm sick and tired of them pointing up here and telling us that our way of life is not worth the same value as theirs.
While this is a very compelling narrative to the Western Slope ear, I'm now going to read an excerpt from Tom Bukowski's September Denver Post op-ed, the one that Andy Mueller called unhinged, and I want you to listen as if you live in Phoenix, and you have for your whole life. The letter reads, Arizona, California, and Nevada have put forth a post-2026 operational proposal that requires mandatory, certain, and verifiable water use reductions of additional billions of gallons of water by the three lower basin states. In summary, we're doing our part. But the letter continues, to the contrary, Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, and New Mexico have not agreed, nor have they proposed any mandatory, certain, and verifiable reductions in their water use, not one single gallon. Instead, they propose the water use reductions needed to save the Colorado River come solely from Arizona, California, and Nevada. End quote. Now, if you're sitting in your air-conditioned Phoenix home reading that letter, you'd think, yeah, what the heck? We're living in a desert here, making all kinds of sacrifices, and Colorado can't commit to any reductions? You can see why these state-level negotiators are in a very difficult position. Of course, Tom Bukowski's letter didn't mention that we make mandatory reductions via our prior appropriation system every year, and it's likely that the general population in urban Phoenix doesn't understand that Colorado water law makes us do that. But just in case you're wondering about the gravity of these negotiations, Tom Bukowski's letter that, remember, was co-signed by the entire Arizona State Legislature, ends like this. Quote, the path we are on can be best captured by a quote from William Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. Cry havoc and let slip the dogs of war. End quote. They want to see at least some mandatory, certain, and verifiable water use reductions from the upper basin. Meanwhile, we in the upper basin say,
the answer is no, you can't have it. The law says no, we're not going to dry up and blow away just because you want to grow in a way that is unsustainable.
The operational guidelines that govern the Colorado River expire at the end of 2026. But legal timelines, especially for the National Environmental Protection Act, or NEPA, say that we should be working on implementation of agreed-to operating guidelines now. Andy Mueller of the Colorado River District says,
my best guess is it's about a 50-50 chance of them reaching that agreement.
If the federal government steps in and dictates the operating guidelines, the issue is very likely to end up in the Supreme Court. What's clear is that the lower basin states have not been living within the hydrology of the river, as we upper basin states are forced to. They've been taking more water out of Lake Powell and Lake Mead than has been flowing in for some 20 years. It's also clear that given today's hot, dry conditions, someone in the Colorado River Basin is going to be living with a lot less water in the coming years. The question is, who? For KVNF News, I'm Brody Wilson. You're listening to Local Motion, KVNF's weekly public affairs show. I'm Brody Wilson, If you missed some of the first half of our show, you can always listen by looking for Local Motion under the News tab at kbnf.org. And if you want to learn more about the current state of the Colorado River Basin and the negotiations between Upper Basin and Lower Basin states, the Colorado River District's 75-minute presentation is available at the Montrose County website. You can find it by Googling West Slope Water Summit and navigating to the Montrose County website. We now move from the Water Summit in Montrose up to a regenerative farm in Gunnison, where KBNF's Laura Palmisano brings us this conversation with Susan Wyman from Gunnison Gardens.
Explain to us where we are and what it looks like here.
Sure. We are a rural urban farm located within the city limits of the city of Gunnison. We are 3.93 acres, just about 4 acres. And we're a farm that's hidden in plain sight. There are unpaved city streets all around us, and we've been in business for 11 years.
What is it like farming in this Gunnison Valley area?
It's very cold. Our farm is located in a frost pocket in a really cold city. So sometimes I tell people it was a stupid place to place a farm. But if you want to learn how to grow food in a cold climate, this is definitely the place to do it. We had frost during August of this year, frost once a week in July and even into August. So we've had very few frost-free growing days this year, but we managed to grow a lot of food here.
How much food do you grow, if you have an estimate?
Oh, I would have to look that up in our tables. We keep track of all of our sales and so on, but well, just for example, this year we did 3 different farmers markets and 2 full-on CSAs. So we're feeding a lot of families. I don't have the exact weight, but it's amazing how much food you can grow in a really small space with this intensive style of agriculture.
Explain your style of agriculture.
We are a diversified organic non-certified farm. By diversified farm, I mean we grow a variety of different crops. We grow at least 34 different types of vegetables here, and we practice extensive crop rotation, so we don't plant the same crop in the same place more than every 3 to 4 years. And we have 100-foot long rows, and we'll grow 2 or 3 rows of each individual thing. Say 300-foot-long rows of broccoli and 600-foot-long rows of cabbage and 200-foot-long rows of leeks. So we grow, you know, reasonable quantities of a lot of different produce.
How did you get started farming in Gunnison?
Well, I was a hydrologist and civil engineer for about 30 years, and one day I was in my office working on statistics and technical reports and databases and all of the things that I did, and I found this 4-acre property online. So I was supposed to be working, and I was dreaming about land and food production. I had been a backyard gardener my whole life, and then I had a technical professional career and just felt this call, felt this tug, found the 4 acres, rode my bike over to look at the land. It was basically a big thistle-infested field. And I rode my bike over to the real estate agent, said, "What's up with this property?" Rode my bike over to the city and said, "Am I allowed to have a farm and garden on this lot?" And rode my bike back and suggested to my husband that we buy this land. And that's kind of how it got started. And for the first few years, I kept one foot in the world of consulting, while I had consulting hydrology, that is, while I had a foot in agriculture and the farm. So it has taken a while to ramp up to the scale that we're at now, 11 years in fact. And so it was a bit of a slow change, but once I got on the track of farming and diversified small-scale agriculture, I just couldn't quit.
Are you a native to Gunnison?
No, I actually grew up in northern Idaho, and I met my husband from Colorado while I was in Idaho, and I moved here 1993, so I've been here more than half my life.
Did you grow up on a farm?
No, I grew up in Idaho, which is fairly rural, and we always had a large garden. My family, we fed ourselves from a garden. My dad hunted, and so we were very into food production and sustainability before sustainability was really a word. We were just a Western family that grew our food and hunted and raised rabbits and did just those basic things that felt very normal to me as a child. And now I think for a lot of suburban dwellers and even rural dwellers, that can seem strange because now so much food and such variety of food is available in the grocery store. And as grocery store food quality has declined, I think the importance of growing local food has increased.
You mentioned you're at three farmers markets, three separate farmers markets during the season. Where are you and what are you selling?
We attend the Gunnison Farmers Market every Saturday, and that's 19 or 20 weeks long. The Crested Butte Farmers Market is also about 20 weeks long, and we're there every Sunday all season. And then CB South has a farmers market on Thursdays. That one is finished for the year, but it was 10 weeks long. So our farm doesn't miss a market. When we make a commitment, we follow through. So we're there every Thursday, Saturday, Sunday.
How does your farm run? Is it just you? Do you have helpers?
Oh, I can't do this by myself. It's a very labor-intensive operation. We do have a tractor, but we don't plow. We're a no-till farm. So we mostly use the tractor to offload chicken feed, and we get many thousands of pounds of chicken feed every month. So the actual work of vegetable production requires quite a few of us. Me, I'm the lead farmer, and I'm out here more than full-time. And then I have a right-hand man who's my Ag Workforce Development intern this year, Jamie, works with me 4 full days a week. And I have apprentices. So we have a registered apprenticeship program. It's certified by the state of Colorado, and it's funded in part by Ginning Farmer and Rancher Development Program, BFRDP. And that grant has funded for our farm 2.5 apprentices. I'm teaching and training 3 apprentices, and they are learning all aspects of farming. So as they work out here to grow the food, they're learning constantly. And they learn indoor seed starting, transplanting, direct sowing, soil health, business management, farmers market and sales. And there's also a personal health and wellness aspect of it, because this kind of work can be really difficult on the body, and in some ways it can be mentally challenging. So we try to give these apprentices the tools they need to succeed running a diversified market farm such as this one.
Now, how long have you done the apprenticeship program?
This is the first year. So 2025 was the first year of the formal apprenticeship program, the certified registered apprenticeship program. But prior to that, I've been teaching on this farm basically since I started. Not a lot of people can afford to come out here if you're an experienced farmer and work for what I pay. So I find a lot of college students, even high school students, and folks that are just interested in learning how to farm. And that tends to be, to me, younger people in their late teens, mid-20s, maybe even into their early 30s that want to learn this and can afford to work and learn. I mean, you'll get vegetables and eggs. The pay rate isn't that high. The quality of life is actually outstanding, and it's good physical work, so you don't need a gym program, and you're learning constantly.
How do you feel about training the next generation of farmers?
It matters more than anything. Every human eats 3 times a day, every day. If we're lucky, we eat 3 times a day. As our financial system changes, as our fossil fuel system changes, local food is going to be more important than ever. Also, one of the phrases that I use is, you can pay your farm or pay your pharmacist. This type of food is critical to human health. And we grow food with no added synthetic chemicals, no pesticides, no herbicides. This food can make you healthy, can keep you healthy, and you can live a life of abundance and health, abundant health with this food. And to teach new people how to create, well, nature creates, we just facilitate. But to teach people how to help nature grow food in this way is, in my opinion, critical for the future.
In your years teaching agriculture on this scale to individuals. Have other people started their own farms or gardens?
Oh, yeah. Because I've teamed with Mountain Roots, and Mountain Roots used to send their farm team here, I've known several farmers that came out of this operation, took what they used, and transferred it to their own farms and their operations. Or they moved out of the Gunnison Valley and went to work on other farms. It's very collaborative. And I also say, I don't know everything about farming, but I will teach you everything I know. And that's the best that I can do. And my hope would be that folks come out here, they see what we're doing, they take the best parts, leave with that. And whether they become full-on farmers, backyard gardeners, homesteaders, whatever it takes, take this knowledge and go out and produce food where you're at. Grow where you're planted.
You do regenerative farming. Explain that to our listeners.
Can I make a joke? Regenerative agriculture is garbage and poop. So, you know, we talk about nutrient cycling. We have a lot of chickens on our farm, and none of that chicken manure goes to waste. We compost everything. When we raised meat birds, and this is the first year in quite a while that we haven't raised meat birds, we would compost every part of it. So I think regenerative agriculture is recognizing that nutrient cycling occurs in so many ways, and we just try to keep all that is good on the land, return it to the soil. What agriculture shouldn't do is extract, extract, extract without giving back. So regenerative agriculture is giving back to the land and finding that harmony where we're amending the soil enough that we can keep the farm growing healthy food and to do it with the real products that come off the land.
Explain to us a bit more about how the apprenticeship program works.
Sure. We are bringing in 3 apprentices each year, and it's a 22-month program. And an individual who's interested could apply through the Mountain Roots Food Project. And once selected, we bring the apprentices in early in the spring, early March, when there is still snow on the ground here and the ground is frozen. And we start with the educational aspect of it. And most of that is indoor teaching. And the apprentice is paid the entire time.
You left a job at a desk to come out to the land. Why did you do that?
There was a tug that I can't entirely describe. I had always been a backyard gardener. I had always wanted to have my hands in the dirt. My career as a geologist, hydrologist, civil engineer had a mix of desk work and field work. I would go out and drill wells. I was a mining hydrologist, which is almost the antithesis of being an organic farmer. Mining has an impact on society. And at some point, I looked at who I was and I looked at what I was doing, and I decided that I just had to answer this call. And when I was a hydrologist, I thought I was a pretty good hydrologist. I did really good work for my clients. I understood the physical world that I was working in. But what I didn't understand was something that's a little bit beyond the physical. We use a lot of science out here, but we use a lot of intuition to grow healthy, nutrient-dense food. And so even though I used my brain a lot as an engineer and a hydrologist, I get to use all parts of me out here. I get to use my heart and my brain and my intuition and my muscles. So I think that call was something I just couldn't deny.
Thank you for your time, Susan.
Thank you.
That's all we have time for today. This has been Local Motion, KVNF's weekly public affairs show. If you missed a portion of the show that you'd like to listen to, look for Local Motion under the news tab at kvnf.org. And thanks, as always, for listening to your mountain-grown community radio for Western Colorado, KVNF.